The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Our aim is to explore the fringe, lost civilizations, alternative science, the paranormal, and much more. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live or future guests via email or the live chat room. And remember to subscribe to us on iTunes. And now welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
So, I am your host, Soraya, and tonight on Where Did the Road Go, we have Cal Cooper, all the way from the UK. And where in the UK are you, Cal?
Right at the moment, I'm in Nottinghamshire, which is my hometown. But the rest of my time I spend in Northampton, where the University of Northampton is based.
Ah, okay. And you are working on a PhD in parapsychology, correct?
Yep, that's correct. It's more or less parapsychology. As I say, there are elements of looking at positive psychology in there and death, dying, and bereavement. The PhD itself is exploring post-death experiences. So during the bereavement stage, how many people report having unusual experiences, and what do they report these experiences to be, and how do they affect them? So this could be anything from just after losing someone, you wake at night to see an apparition at the end of your bed, or you start to experience poltergeist activity, or you have an unusual telephone call, or you sense the presence of the dead, their touch, maybe their smell, maybe hear their voice, bangs, raps, or maybe even dream of the dead. So there's such a wide variety of things that people during the bereavement stage experience that since the 1970s, mainstream science has been taking very seriously, since a publication by a guy called Dr. Dewey Rees from his medical doctorate thesis called The Hallucinations of Widowhood. And so since then, parapsychology in the last 10 years has started to tentatively pick apart these experiences and see how beneficial parapsychological experiences are to the bereaved. So that's why it's a bit of parapsychology and a bit of everything else as well.
How did you get interested in this stuff?
Specifically the PhD or parapsychology?
Parapsychology.
Well, parapsychology I became interested in having grown up in Nottinghamshire. Every county within the UK has got its own ghosts, folklore and legends of all kinds of things. And there's many different counties that boast being the most haunted place in England. I believe Derby was the last place to boast that it had the most amount of active hauntings and a considerable amount of ley lines allegedly running underneath it. But Nottingham's got its fair share. It's got the classic legend of Robin Hood. It's got two of the oldest reported pubs in the world, the Trip to Jerusalem and the Salutation Inn. And when I was growing up, those places were brilliant. You could go on ghost walks there, learn about all the different ghosts that haunted the pubs and also around the main city of Nottingham. And at school as well, whenever I went to the library, myself and several friends, we'd always go off to this one specific section which had around about 8 to 10 books that were simplified on the paranormal. Bear in mind, I was only like 8 to 10 at the time, but they were fantastic. And we were looking up pictures of alleged UFO photographs and sightings of Bigfoot, encounters with aliens, people that thought they'd seen the Loch Ness Monster, and then some classic hauntings, looking at people that claim they'd seen ghosts and taken photographs of them, or learning about Borley Rectory, which was named the most haunted house in England by the famous ghost hunter Harry Price in the 1930s. So learning about that at an early age, I think, sort of kicked off the interest. It got me questioning, are these experiences real? Do they hold any objective value? Or is it really all in the mind? That's something that I started to consider later. Are we creating these, which is why they're not so regularly available to actually have these experiences? People talk about them, but it's very rare you have one of these experiences for yourself, or at least the wide range of experiences that are reported. So by the time I got to college and I dabbled with thinking about getting a career in acting, I realized that if I got qualifications in psychology, they'd be a brilliant string to add to my bow, because later on I could apply psychology to many different job avenues, and realized that after college, if I went on to university to study it, which I did, I could actually select a specific university that would teach a module of parapsychology within the third year and also allows you to freely research it. So for the dissertation element of the degree, I could do a whole study on parapsychology. And I considered a few universities within the UK that cater for this, and picked the University of Northampton in the end, which has the largest research centre currently in the world for paranormal phenomena in relation to psychology, we have the Center for the Study of Anomalous Psychological Processes, which is abbreviated to CSAP, and incorporates a department of people specializing in parapsychology and transpersonal psychology, which is looking at altered states of consciousness and religious and peak experiences.
Oh, all right. Have you ever had any experiences yourself?
I've never seen a ghost myself. I've never had a strange telephone call. I've never seen the Loch Ness Monster. Probably once or twice I've seen unusual at nighttime with several other people. Probably seen something unusual in the sky, but there's no way of figuring out whether that was a genuine helicopter or a plane or whatever. But you think, well, that's an unusual shape and unusual lightings and unusual movement. A lot of people report those. But in terms of just stuff we can boil down to parapsychology, I've been on a few investigations where I've been with, say, police officers or other researchers, and we experienced what we believed to be poltergeist activity. We couldn't find a rational explanation for it, and that involved throwing objects off into a room, an empty room, room that only had a table in it, and two people reported having a metal washer thrown at them. So we threw it back out and just asked out into the room, could someone, if anyone's there, could you throw it back? Just humoured it. We wouldn't normally do this in terms of real research. It was just end of the night, and we thought, well, I'll do it for the sake of doing it. And something got thrown back at incredible speed past my head and fellow researchers, hit the door behind us and then fell on the floor. It's something completely different. It was a plastic Y connector. And in other instances, we've done that with throwing rocks, and a rock comes back on command, again, throwing it out into an empty room. Or we're in a place where there was a load of kids' play balls, like juggling balls and ball pond balls and stuff like that, and they were being thrown left, right and center from areas of the room where no one was stood, and that was caught on camera from two different angles. And also I think we did a few trigger object experiments in Clifton Hall, where we drew round an old penny and some whistles, and when we came back, I was the last one to leave the room after setting it up and the first one to return. And the penny had moved about a good centimetre outside of the circle. For me, that was quite unique, even though no one was there to witness it. But at least we can definitely say no one was in the room to have done it themselves. It was only myself and two other researchers in the entire hall that whole night, and I had the keys to the place. So there's been a few strange experiences, but only really poltergeist activity, if it really was poltergeist activity.
And one of the theories around poltergeist activity is it's generally related to teenagers going through puberty. It seems to connect to them. Did you have anyone around when these things were happening, or did it seem to be attached to the location?
Well, that was the general theory that I think has become popularized, but people that you could class as, say, experts on poltergeist, like Guy Lyon Playfair, who wrote This House is Haunted, who documented the Enfield poltergeist, he gave a conference presentation. He was sat on a panel with some other experts last September at the University of Bath. And he was saying that because of popular literature and also media, a lot of people assume that poltergeists always focus around someone going through puberty. And that's not necessarily the case. It's just some of the most unique cases just so happen to have young people present. There are loads of cases of haunted houses that not only have apparitions and strange voices heard throughout the place and movement of, leading to that, the movement of objects, even though no one might live in that building anymore. They might report poltergeist activity where members of the public go in to visit this place, or staff working there that go in now and then, they report seeing poltergeist activity. There's no one living there permanently 24/7 that you could say the activity is focused around, and it changes if you take them in and out of the environment. Even though there are a lot of cases that suggest it's probably promoted by a young person being present, I wouldn't say that's necessarily always the case. And there's also an element of skepticism involved, because in the Enfield case, they found that quite a few times they caught the children tricking the researchers. And you've got to question, well, is the child aware of what's going on? Are they playing along? Are they actually creating a hoax sometimes? And other times it seems that you can find that it seems to be genuine. Certain feats happen that the child couldn't possibly have been responsible for, like flipping a table that even an adult struggles to actually lift and turn over, a big old oak table or something like that, or setting fire to things that are completely out of reach of the child, or moving things that are out of reach of the child. So, there's loads of cases where it is focused around the child, but I wouldn't always say there's a definite connection there.
Do you think that there's one phenomena responsible for this, or do you think there's different things that produce similar results?
Well, for poltergeist activity, it goes two ways. Most parapsychologists can put themselves into, and psychologists really, in general, they can put themselves into two camps, being dualists or holists for psychologists, and that's believing that the mind is all in one, it's connected to the biological organism of the brain, and when we die, that all dies with it. There are people that act as dualists and believe that mind and body acts completely differently, and that consciousness doesn't hold a fixed locality to the mind. So you can bring this into parapsychology, and there's researchers that think that all this activity that we experience, that we label as paranormal, is down to either extrasensory perception or psychokinesis, both elements of psi phenomena. On the other scale, though, there are parapsychologists that accept that survival could be possible. So they believe that ESP and PK are responsible, but also there are some instances of, say, mediumship, hauntings, apparitions, reincarnation, near-death experiences, and so forth, that suggest that the mind is capable of living on after death. So you can break poltergeist activity down into that. Can we actually explain poltergeist activity via psychokinesis alone? And because we believe things are moving on their own, or we want something to move that we've set up as an experiment, we've done it ourselves via our own mind and the way that we're thinking. We've manipulated the environment around us and caused it to move. On the other scale, though, people put poltergeist down to being discarnate entities, and they're moving things independently, and they're the ones getting in contact via the Ouija board or the table tipping and so forth. Certainly, though, it's very much more explainable via the camp of psychokinesis, and also the fact that it's a placebo effect. If we've been told that the place is haunted, maybe we might start actually playing that along in our minds, and we start interpreting things in different ways. Certainly when we look at groups of skeptics and believers of the paranormal and put them in a haunted location, both groups will completely judge things differently. There was a famous study done with several parapsychologists looking at Hampton Court Palace, and they split members of the public up into groups of skeptics and believers. And the skeptics would rationalize everything they experienced a lot more than the group of paranormal believers. They'd instantly jump to a paranormal conclusion, whereas the skeptic that feels a draft wouldn't put it down to, say, a ghost allegedly walking past them. They'd look for drafts, doors open, windows open, and so forth. And they'd measure drops in temperature by looking at, you know, well, am I close to a window? Am I close to a door? And so forth. They just rationalize everything as much as they could. And also, when you look at psychology studies of skeptics and believers in the paranormal, a skeptic of the paranormal is more capable of appraising coincidental events than a paranormal believer is. So looking at statistics and chance coincidence and so forth. So there's a lot of different things to consider there.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, the other thing I find is that a lot of people who call themselves skeptics are not so much skeptics as much as debunkers, disbelievers, people who are going to find any explanation to explain away things, even if it's not, even if that explanation is more incredible than saying, hey, something anomalous happened here.
Mm-hmm.
And do you find that often when you deal with skeptics?
It varies, really. I mean, you get some people that say they're skeptical and then their approach is just completely radical and they seem to be an absolute believer.
Uh-huh.
And then you get other people that say they're skeptical and their attitude is more so cynical. And it doesn't matter what you point in front of them, any lab studies with incredible statistics or field studies where controls have been put in place as far as possible, they're just not willing to actually accept what's in front of them. And so when you get to that mindset, there's no point in even saying that you're, you know, a credible scientist or so forth, when you're just discarding things because of your own personal mindset that you don't want there to be evidence of these kinds of phenomena, ESP, PK, and any kinds of haunting phenomena and so forth. You know, you're out of the game. You have to be open-minded, but question everything. So be a skeptic, be open-minded, and just question everything that comes along. Everyone that puts a status on what they are, they seem to vary from person to person. I would put the label on myself as being an open-minded skeptic. And yes, I've said, yeah, I've had experiences. I've seen what I believe to be poltergeist in a few poltergeist cases and poltergeist activity in a few instances. But that hasn't changed my belief system or my mindset. The next person that comes along and says that they've got a haunted house with poltergeist activity, it doesn't mean, say, I'm going to jump to the conclusion straight away and say, well, they must definitely be having that. I'll go along and judge it and see what's going on. So every case has to be judged on its merits. And there are some cynics, some skeptics within other science domains that just jump to conclusions too quickly because they've based their conclusions on their belief, not judging each and every case that comes along.
Right. Right. Okay. Which makes it sound more like you're a true skeptic, because a true skeptic asks questions.
Mm-hmm.
And questions everything. It's, you know, and I think the term has kind of been hijacked along the way.
Yeah.
Now, you've written a book called Telephone Calls from the Dead. When did this come out?
Telephone Calls from the Dead was released very early in 2012.
Okay. And where did you acquire data for this?
I'm literally just writing a follow-up paper at the moment talking about where the data came from and how it was analysed that's hopefully going to be published in one of the next issues of the Australian Journal of Parapsychology, where I've published on this before. Don't ask me why I picked that specific one. There are loads of different parapsychology journals, and I could have gone for just the General Journal of Parapsychology, but since I published in there before, I thought I may as well follow it up. The participants came from, and the cases came from a variety of different places. One set of data came from D. Scott Rogo's case file after he died in 1990, which is mentioned in the book. He was murdered and was the main author of the original book. All of his notes and files and books were donated to the Californian Institute of Integral Studies. So they were housed in the library and all boxed up. And during the writing of the book, I asked them if they had any files by Scott that were written after the book was published. So they went through all the boxes and found a folder that just said on it, new cases. And it was all telephone cases and follow-up interviews that were conducted between Scott and Raymond Bayliss, with people that claimed that they'd had an unusual telephone call, not just from the dead, but some impossible calls that couldn't really have taken place. Say, you ring a friend, they answer the phone, you have a conversation, phone goes down, and you later find out that at the time that you called them, they weren't actually home at the time to have taken the call. And you find that out because when you speak to them in person, they don't recall the call whatsoever. And they can verify that they were out of town and with other people at the time, yet someone at their place, at their residence, via their number, answered with their personal characteristics and so forth, and understood who you were and what you were going to say. So the data came from Scott's file, some of it. The rest came from the fact that I published a few papers and done a few conference presentations looking at reviving the research, because I noted the fact that this was 30 years down the line since Phone Calls from the Dead was published in 1979. And this interests a lot of the general public. I did a lot of radio interviews and some newspaper articles. And as I say, the general papers that I published to the academic community. And this brought a lot of people emailing me or people in person coming to me and telling me about their cases. So these were followed up via long email correspondence or one-to-one interviews, and then also writing out an eyewitness testimony for what they can recall of the phone call. It could have taken place a few weeks beforehand, a few months, a few years, or even several years down the line. So with the data set I got, I put it together with the unpublished data set of Scott Rogo and just specifically looked at cases of the telephone, even though there were cases of text messages and emails that just weren't simply enough to analyze. So they're mentioned in the book, and a few cases are mentioned in the book, but not enough for an independent analysis of those. But strictly conversations and cases with landline telephones and digital technology with the digital mobile phones, and that's where all the data set came from.
All right, what would you say one of your most compelling cases in the book is?
One of the most compelling cases, which I'd love to come back to, was published in the book and also in a previous paper, and it was reported to me by a guy that I referred to as Dr. Jones. He was a lecturer in psychology and sociology, and that's what his doctorate was in as well. And in his early life, he recalled that a time round about the age of 11, his parents had split up but were still living together amicably, and they'd both gone off and found new partners. His mother, though, had fallen in love again with a childhood sweetheart they'd recently remet. And regularly, about 3 to 4 times a week, they would have a long telephone conversation, and she'd take the telephone to the bathroom and speak to this guy. Later on down the line, though, several months later, the guy fell ill and ended up in hospital, but she would still speak to him via the telephone he'd call from hospital. And then she found out that he'd actually passed away, and she was in disbelief of the whole situation, and very distraught, very grief-stricken. And then the next week, there was a telephone call that came through. She went through to answer it in the kitchen, and then some 20 minutes later, she came back white as a sheet, and the family said, "What's wrong?" And she said, "Richard just called." Now, this is in the time before Ghostbusters and anything like that. So what do you do? This is the 1960s, and you've just had what you appear to, or what you believe to be, a telephone call from the dead. And, you know, you can't call the police and get them to look into it. What are you going to do? And all they did was accept it, because there was no one to call. These people probably weren't aware of the American or British branch of the Society for Psychical Research, or any universities that specialized in parapsychology. So they just accepted it. And these calls then went on. They continued. They were repeated. 3 to 4 times a week, this guy Richard would call. She'd go out of the room, take the call, speak to this guy for 20 minutes. And this went on for 3 years. And later on, it's about 6 or 7 years ago now, Dr. Jones's mother passed away. And he managed to get hold of a 5-year diary, which he kept at the time, in which the 3 years' worth of the calls are all logged, which he found was fascinating when he read back through them. And he looked into the content, he sent them to me, and they were very repetitive. Every time she got this call from this guy, they would say, "Sunday evening, my darling phoned to say that he loved me and would be at my side. I am sad, but then he tells me to be happy, and I feel great again. He comes on the wind. He says that he will always be at my side. He's going to call again soon." And it is very much the same, just like that, very romantic. But she mentions these strange winds and static, and that's where his voice comes from. And she asks where he is, and it's a beautiful place. And at one time, Dr. Jones, as a child, when she was out, his mother was out, a telephone call came through, and he went to answer it. And he picked it up and heard static, this strange whooshing sound, and a voice slowly coming out of it. So petrified, he just shouted, "She's not here," and slammed the telephone down. And later on, just completely regretted it. He wished that he'd just hung on just to actually hear what this guy's voice sounded like. Now, this can go two ways. This is during the time of a big breakup between the parents, even though it was amicable afterwards. Did the father want to get his own back on the mother, and he'd asked a friend to like wind her up, but play a joke on her? But if so, no, it's so long-winded. About 2 to 3 years worth of calls, 3 to 4 times a week. I mean, that's a commitment to a prank call over a long period of time. It's still possible. It's very possible, because we don't know. I mean, all that time's gone now. This is the 1960s. All we've got is the eyewitness testimony of one guy and a diary. That's all that's left behind. But from the outlook of it, and comparing it to some of the phone calls that Rogo and Bayliss reported, it certainly got the characteristics of being a telephone call from the dead. And they had a few cases where the dead person would ring back a few times, but not to the length of several months or a year or several years. So for me, that was an absolutely fascinating case. If it is genuine, it's just on two sides, though. It's either fraud or it's genuine.
Okay. Have there been any multiple witnesses? Like you said, the son answered the phone there, but he didn't really talk to him. Have there been cases where other people have heard these phone calls?
Yeah, there have, and that adds a lot of credit to the calls, just like in cases where multiple people see ghosts, which we call collective cases. There are instances of type 2 telephone calls, which are called prolonged calls, and they're where you have an extended telephone conversation with someone that you know, could be about half an hour or so. You put the phone down, and then afterwards you find out that that person had died, say, 24 hours before you took that call, or a week, and you didn't know about it. Thinking back to the call that you actually had and what occurred in it, you realize that a lot of the things that they were saying were very final and unusual as well. Their characteristics had changed slightly. And in those situations, though, you could have the lucky chance that if it's someone that they know and they're with other people at the time, they then pass the telephone around the room and say, "Oh, so-and-so is on the line. Do you want to have a word with them as well? Say hello." So then there's multiple witnesses to verify. And then sometimes, luckily, these people, after they found out that it was an unusual call, they check with the telephone company to see where the telephone call came from and so forth. And there's no record of that call taking place.
And that was going to be my next question. Has anyone ever... So people have actually tried to track these calls.
Yeah. In some cases, it could just produce a withheld number, which adds a lot of sort of skepticism to it as to whether it was a prank call. But in a lot of the ones that appear to be genuine and have this element suggestive of survival of death by the person on the line discussing things that only that deceased person would know, it seems that there's no record of that telephone call taking place. Same goes for text messages as well. There's some brilliant cases of texting poltergeists, and all the genuine text messages that you've sent have been logged by the phone company. Yet all the paranormally received text messages that you're getting, they don't appear to show up on the bill whatsoever, or being logged as coming into your phone. And a lot of the time, those text messages don't display any sender information, any date, any number, or anything like that. It's just purely the message.
You know what it makes me think of? It makes me think of John Keel's work when he was researching the Mothman, and he would get these weird phone calls and try to trace them, and there was no – the phone company said no one had called you.
Mm. I mentioned that in the book, The Mothman Prophecies, and John Keel's work, only briefly, discussing the idea that people had telephone calls from aliens and extraterrestrials. And this was followed up with an article that I published in Anomaly, the Journal of Research into the Paranormal, which is published by ASAP. And that's the Association for the Scientific Study of Anomalous Phenomena. I wrote the article with a guy called Clay Foley, who used to contribute to the Canadian Ufologist. And we compared cases that were allegedly telephone calls from the dead and telephone calls from extraterrestrials. So the article was called "Did ET Phone Home or Was It the Dead?" And we were just looking at the psychological element to these calls. Why does one set of people interpret to be a deceased person, and why does the other set of people interpret it to be from aliens? But again, we looked at that element of, is this call logged? Does it show up on the bill, and so forth? But we dug down in this article mainly to the psychology behind these calls and why people interpret them in different ways.
No, I felt that way with a lot of paranormal phenomena. For instance, someone sees a light in the sky, it becomes an extraterrestrial. They see a light in a house, and it becomes a ghost.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, or if you're a skeptic, it's just, you know, a reflection of something somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah, there's that as well. And especially if you're seeing this apparition at nighttime and there's only a little bit of lighting about the house, or, you know, you're near a window and maybe a car drives by and the headlights reflect off your window and then casts a light straight across your bedroom wall and it looks like an apparition fleeting by to some person, especially when you're in a semi-sleepy dream state, something like that, it just gets misinterpreted. It's most likely to be misinterpreted. A lot of paranormal experiences are reported at nighttime, particularly with apparitions. And one particular parapsychologist who's done a lot of work on this is Dr. Simon Sherwood. Because he had an unusual experience as a child of a black dog apparition, but he experienced it when he was in bed. So he then later on, when he became a psychologist, he looked at these states of sleeping and waking called hypnagogia and hypnopompia. And it's just the state when we're just starting to go to sleep and just waking up from sleep, and we start to confuse dreams with reality. You know, you dream of the doorbell going, and you quickly jump up from bed thinking maybe it's the mailman wanting you to sign for something. You quickly go to the door and there's no one there or yeah. Something like that. And you've just completely misinterpreted. Your dream sort of entered reality and sort of shocked you a little bit. And there's loads of reports of people saying that they heard the telephone ring while dreaming and they woke up and answered the phone and there was no one there. Well, it's most likely because they were dreaming of the telephone ringing. It wasn't actually ringing. Or they thought in their dream someone was stood at the end of their bed, and as they wake up, it starts to become apparent that there's someone stood there, but it could just be the dressing gown hanging at the end of the bed, and in poor lighting, you know, it just gets misinterpreted. There's so many different things that can creep in terms of rational explanations when someone reports something having happened at nighttime.
Right, right. And I've had plenty of hypnagogic experiences just like that, where I hear, say, someone knock, and I jolt awake, and I go, wait, no, that didn't actually happen.
Absolutely. It's so common.
And once you get used to it, you know, happening enough, you can kind of identify when it's happening, because you realize, no, I wasn't completely awake. You know, I might get up and check the door anyway just to be sure, but...
I've done it loads of times. So,
so with these phone calls, like, Do you find people faking them at all in any of your research?
No, I mean, the ones that just seem too suspicious, they just weren't included, or I didn't follow them up. If they're in email contact with me, I just thank them very much for getting in contact and taking the time to pass it on. But some of them, the cases were just too weak, or they were perfectly explainable via rational means, so I just had to be polite about the way that I went about it, engaging the correspondence. Nothing that kind of cropped up as obvious fraud. Everyone was kind of genuine. It only seems fraudulent, and this happens a lot. Someone that did a brief study of this in the 1980s, there was only one other study besides what I did and what Scott Rogo and Raymond Bayliss did, and that was an Italian study of telephone calls from the dead by a guy called Dr. Massimo Biondi. And he published his report in a couple of Italian parapsychology journals. And he found that when he went on radio or did newspaper articles to advertise for people that have had these experiences, he got loads of people that got in contact with him. And they would write about their experience or something like that. And yet when he contacted them to follow it up, they weren't willing to be interviewed, or they weren't willing to write an account and sign and date it or anything like that. And I found that loads of times. I mean, when I've been on things like Coast to Coast AM and many other radio shows, sometimes I get floods of emails from people wanting to discuss their experience. And let's say the last time that I was on Coast to Coast AM, I probably had about 30 people that seemed to be adamant they had a good, solid case. And to read it as an email, it was fascinating. But I said, you know, we're going to have to follow this up and make an actual account out of this. I need to interview you. I need to ask some questions. And when it came to saying, yeah, you know, at the end of this, there's going to need to be at least some report. It wouldn't, you know, in some cases, it might just be a page. It might be several pages, but you need to sign and date it. And we need to go through it together. They weren't willing to, or they just stopped communication. And you're like, well, something a little bit dodgy is going on there. They were so keen and eager to contact me. But is that for, you know, what's the motive behind this person? Are they after a bit of media fame? You know, you find that the genuine people do seep through, and out of 40 people that contact you, you could get 3 people that cooperate all the way through. So it's certainly an odd one.
Huh. It also sounds, it's one of those things that also tends to be an urban myth where people relate the story that their friend got this type of phone call and things like that as well.
Yeah, if it's been passed on from person to person, God knows what the actual truth was at the original starting point of the story. I mean, this is why you get ghosts and legends of various towns. I mean, what was the actual original circumstance in which that took place, and why has it got to the point that it has now, and how does it get that way? We've got loads of those. One of the most famous haunted locations right near where I am right now doing this interview is Newstead Abbey. And that's the former home of the poet Lord Byron. And Newstead Abbey has several ghosts. There's the White Lady, the Black Friar, and Bosun the dog. Bosun was Byron's dog. And all of those haunt the grounds, though all the stories connected to them are complete legend. That they've been passed on for hundreds of years. And so it's very rare for anyone in recent times to report those ghosts. I mean, the Black Friar was only really reported by Byron's family when someone was terminally ill, and it was a sign that they were going to die very soon, like within the next 24 hours. And it was Byron's family and Byron himself that often reported seeing Bosun the dog haunting some of the grounds. And with the White Lady, there's been a few very weak accounts. You don't know where they got reported, if it was just local newspapers or whatever. Outside the main entrance to Newstead Abbey, it's about another half-mile drive to the actual abbey outside the main entrance gates, and there's an old bus stop there, which is still used. It's the main route in and out of Nottingham. And quite a few times, through hearsay and story, bus drivers have stopped at that bus stop because there was a woman stood there in a white flowing dress, and they thought she was waiting for a bus, and the doors will open, and she looks at them and then just vanishes and creeps them out totally. That one's been passed on. It's so common, but with the other ghosts, though, they've just passed into myth and legend, and they've been carried on that way. So it's best, if you're going to follow up paranormal activity and any kind of case, don't go for the old ones that are connected to an old historic place, unless people are still reporting things regularly on a day-to-day basis. Same goes for the phone calls.
What do you think is the most likely explanation for the phone calls? Do you think it's one thing or multiple possibilities?
Well, they drop into different things. I mean, there was a guy called Roger Anderson, who reviewed Phone Calls from the Dead in 1981 for the Journal of Religion and Psychical Research. And he was adamant that all of the calls could be put down to misinterpretation, dreams, fraud, and suggestion and expectancy. And Rogo, D. Scott Rogo, when he replied to this, he said, that's ridiculous. How many people do you think expect to have a phone call from the dead? There's no suggestion there or expectancy. It falls into the category of psychical research phenomena that we look into, which is spontaneous phenomena. It's called spontaneous because when people report seeing a ghost and having these a premonition that something's going to happen, it's spontaneous. You don't know that you're going to have this experience. It just happens when you least expect it. And this goes for the phone calls. It's very... I don't think I can recall coming across a case where someone was expecting to have a phone call from the dead or an unusual one from the living. So that explanation doesn't really apply, except maybe in some unique cases of bereavement, where that person's a paranormal believer, they might have had some experiences previously, they're sorely missing their friend or relative that's passed away, and they just want anything, any sort of chance of a last goodbye, be it seeing their apparition, witnessing something like poltergeist activity, or maybe having an unusual telephone call. But when you look at these accounts, and especially the original ones, when people reported them, they'd never heard of these kinds of phenomena before, nor were they really interested in the paranormal. So they hadn't looked into it or read into it. So for a suggestion and expectancy, not really. Fraud, very likely. Especially if you can think of anyone that you've recently fallen out with, you had an argument with. Are they the type to seek vengeance and get their own back on people? Even in a cruel situation, such as shortly after that, you lose someone. It's a possibility that we shouldn't rule out. Even though it's very cruel, it's still a possibility. Dreams, we've mentioned that with hypnopompia and hypnagogia. That's also a likely explanation for the calls that occur during the time that we've been asleep. Apart from that, though, misinterpretation, going back to that, it might come in some rare cases, but rarely those cases that get reported get used in the overall analysis. And let's say a mother and father have lost their child and they're grieving, they get a missed call, they get a genuine call, and that person is a child and they just say mum or dad. Mum, dad, and then the phone goes down because that parent might have replied in shock. But that could have just been any kid calling home that got the wrong number and just so happened to say mum or dad, and because that those parents have lost a child, they associate it to be their deceased child. And that's just a coincidental event that is very difficult to follow up, so it's best not to use it in the analysis. There's a book called There Is No Death and There Are No Dead, or something like that, and it's a book regarding ITC. Are the people who wrote it on the tip of my tongue. There are a couple who research EVP. I'm sure if you Google AAEVP, it comes up with them. And they discussed all these different people throughout the world that do various experiments into ITC. And there was a woman very much like those sort of cases where she invited bereaved parents to come to her home and use her computer, in which she could use the computer for the parents to communicate with their deceased child. And all of them were very much convinced that the voice was absolutely their child and the information that was relayed that was accurate. I was so skeptical of this because she only ever used this computer. No one was really allowed to check out the computer, but her too dodgy and very delicate as well. It's quite shocking that, you know, that was allowed to go ahead, but it seems as though she was doing it privately and not through a university or institute or any credited research foundation. She's just offering it as a service, like anyone saying they're a medium and they'll do private readings for money. You know, it's virtually the same thing, but via computer. In one sense, you could say, well, that's very cruel. In another sense, you could say, well, if they're really struggling with the loss of their child, it's positive, it's comforting for them to assume that there's a continued bond with their child and their child has gone on to something else. There are pros and cons to it, and different people will look at it in different ways. But I think we've gone over all the explanations for phone calls from the dead that could possibly come up. The dreams, misinterpretation, and fraud as well.
Do you think that they could actually be phone calls from the dead in some cases?
I think in some cases, if I have to stick my neck out and say, is there parapsychological evidence here for something suggesting survival, I would say in a few cases, yeah, we're stumped for explanations. And all it's pointing to is this topic of survival of death. It seems that there's no record of the call. There could be multiple witnesses. The person on the phone relayed accurate information relating to the deceased. And they, you know, logged the call and everything that happened within it. They acted as a good investigator themselves, having had a strange experience, and they logged the time that it took place and remembered the content of the call. Beyond that, you're just stumped for what could have caused it. So it seems genuine in some cases. Just a few of them seem that you just can't apply it. You can't apply a rational explanation.
Have you had any cases where the information was really negative or hostile to the person getting the call?
Yeah, Rogo mentioned it, though I didn't come across it. He believed that in some cases you could get a telephone call from the dead from an enemy. So someone that you perhaps owed money to, and they die and you think, oh, great, that's it, my debt's cleared. I don't have to pay them back because they're dead. And then they started receiving phone calls from this person and it really sort of freaked them out. I think he mentioned at least one of those in telephone calls from the dead. If not, it could be in some obscure article that he might have published for Fate magazine a while ago. But he certainly mentioned that it is possible to get a phone call from an enemy rather than a loved one.
Interesting. All right, we got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Cal Cooper.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live guests via email or the live chat room. You can also check out our upcoming schedule, blog, links section, book reviews, videos, and links to our Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and much more. That's wheredidtheroadgo.com.
And we are talking to Cal Cooper. You technically are a parapsychologist, correct?
I'm as close as you can get to one. I don't think there's anything else that I could do beyond what I've already done to make me one.
All right. We've been talking about telephone calls from the dead, and I guess the last thing I wanted to cover with this is you said that sometimes people get phone calls or make phone calls to people who are still alive, but they couldn't possibly have talked to them at the time.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, as luck would happen, as I said at the start of the interview, I was just writing up the actual step-by-step analysis for the journal publication, because one of the reviews of my book, and certainly the reviews of the original book, said that the analysis just needed to be absolutely clear. But for a general audience, I didn't want to put it completely in the book as though I was writing a psychology paper. It would have bored people rigid. So I've written the book, and now if anyone's interested, there's a follow-up research paper outlining the analysis. So in that, I've discussed basically what the call types are like, and then I go into the statistics. And here's one of the calls that you're mentioning. It occurred to Scott Rogo, in fact. So one of the researchers collecting the cases, they experienced a few of these themselves, given the fact that during the time of data collection, which took them 2 years, they became aware of these calls and started to actually take a lot more care in phone calls that they took, and realized that sometimes some bizarre ones would happen that day to day you might miss. So here's a call that Scott Rogo had, and it goes like this. It was 4 o'clock on a bright Thursday afternoon, and I was lying on my living room couch thinking about making a phone call to a psychologist I knew at the UCLA Neuropsychiatric Institute. Although I intended to make the call, I never did. About 6 that evening, though, I got the shock of my life when a call came in from the institute and from the office of the very psychologist I had thought about calling. The call was from her research assistant saying he was answering my message. When I asked what in blazes he was talking about, he told me at 4 p.m. a call had come into them from me. The caller had left my name and had asked that the call be returned.
Wow.
So there's one example, and there are many others like that. I even discussed a few more new ones in the modern edition of Telephone Calls from the Dead, which acts as a complete volume 2, as it were. It follows, it's just a second study. So all in all, between the two books, you have an analysis of 100 different unusual telephone calls.
And what kind of explanation could you give for a phone call like that?
Well, let's have a look at this. I mean, Scott, when he was discussing the whole thing, he says, it was 4 o'clock on a bright Thursday afternoon. I was thinking about, I was lying on my living room couch thinking about making a phone call. And he said he was going to mark some papers as well when he was talking around this, instead of actually make that call. Has he been mistaken? Did he briefly make the call, just said, well, it's Scott, tell them to call me back, and he forgot, he just then lay on the couch and fell asleep? Has he misinterpreted the situation himself? The problem is, after that, Scott had several other instances like that, because at the time, Scott had a roommate. And now and then, Scott would go away for several days, and his roommate would go away for several days. And they were sharing an apartment together. Raymond Bayliss would call Scott quite regularly so they could both talk and catch up on research and catch up on this data collection for the book. And a few times, Raymond had actually called. Scott was out, and the flatmate would answer, say, yeah, Scott's out at the moment. I'll make a note, though. I'll tell him that you called and get him to call you back. Then a few days later, Raymond would call back and Scott would answer. And Raymond was completely annoyed with him. And he says, you never called me back. And he said, well, I never got your call. And he said, well, your flatmate said he'd give you the message. And he says, well, my flatmate's been away all week. He left the country or something like that. So no one was in the flat at all. No Scott, no flatmate. So someone with Scott's flatmate's voice, his characteristics and so forth, said he'd take the message. And yet it seems to be this mystery spirit caller or whatever that's answering the phone. It's like butterfly effect, though, or chaos theory. Every time we have this intention, in some case, well, that's an impossible call, that one that fits into type three, an answer call, when you get an answer from someone who isn't actually there, be it dead or alive. But with the one that I described of Scott, intending to make that call, never did, but then someone calls back and say, you left a message. That is like butterfly effect. He had the decision to make the call at 4 o'clock, and instead, he lies on his couch and marks some papers for university. And there's one side of him that did make the call, and there's the other side of him that didn't. And he's the version of him that didn't, yet this other version of him creates an alternative path of reality in which he did make the call, yet no one was in, so he left a message. Or in some instances, it might have had an entire telephone conversation. It just creates different paths of reality. And maybe this explains why people see apparitions of living people. And you're adamant that when you go shopping and you're at the mall, you spot someone that you know. You're adamant that it's them. They're wearing the clothing that they normally wear, that you associate with being attached to them, a particular jacket and something. Hairstyle's the same. You're just adamant it's them. You've got close enough to have a look, but you never called them over or went up to speak to them. And later on, you say, oh, I saw you at the shopping mall earlier. And they say, well, you can't have done. I was at a baseball match all afternoon. So, you know, you can't have seen me. Have they got a twin out there somewhere, or was that actually them having been there before and the environment recorded them being there? Or they intended to go to the mall first and then go to the baseball match, but changed their mind and went straight to the baseball match? Who knows?
Huh. It also has a certain trickster element to it.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
All right. Real quickly, let's get into your other book, Conversations with Ghosts. And this was written partially with Alex Tanis, right?
Yes, also from Beyond the Grave. Alex Tanis passed away the same year as Scott Rogo. Scott Rogo was stabbed to death in his apartment, and Alex Tanis, he was suffering from cancer, went through chemotherapy, and then died of subsequent heart failure. But he didn't publish as many books as Scott. Scott managed to publish around 30 books in total by the age he was 40. And Alex Tanis was in his 60s, and he produced a book called Beyond Coincidence, with Harvey Aardman, which was a biography of his life. Then he did one with Catherine Fair Donnelly on Is Your Child Psychic? And then his final one, which was published a couple of months after he died, was called Dreams, Symbols and Psychic Power, which he co-authored with Timothy Gray. And Conversations with Ghosts was intended to be published. It was a 3-chapter manuscript of all the personal haunting investigations he'd done with Dr. Carlos Osis of the American Society of Psychical Research. And it just never got published. I'd been supported in my research by the Alex Tanis Foundation since 2011. And last year, in fact, it was the year before last, I discovered this manuscript, started reading through it, and I thought, this is great. You know, we could use some of the unpublished stuff to finish this off. So I put it to the general committee when they met up in May usually, and they discussed it and said, yeah, go ahead. So they gave me permission to finish off. I extended his 3 chapters into 6. By using other things he'd written on survival of death and ghosts and hauntings and some interviews that he'd done, all things that were completely unpublished and never been published before. Then I wrote an extended introduction about his life and why this book particularly on ghosts. And then there's an appendices section with some either rare interviews with him that have been discussed before, like an interview with Lloyd Auerbach that Lloyd gave me permission to use, and some other cases that were people's personal accounts of going ghost hunting with Alex, or some other unusual accounts of him going out with various journalists around Portland, Maine to haunted locations. So it's a very neat and tidy little book just specifically on Alex's involvement with ghosts and hauntings.
And Alex had, you said one of the books was about his life growing up, right?
Yeah.
And he had quite a lot of paranormal experiences himself, didn't he?
Well, that's the unique thing about Dr. Alex Tanis. He was a psychic, but contradictorily, he was a parapsychologist too. Throughout his childhood, he had numerous paranormal experiences. He predicted deaths of his family members, especially his father, who his father was also a psychic. It had sort of been passed down through the generations. His father was very understanding of Alex's sensitivity to the world. And he predicted the death of his siblings, and then had a very Catholic upbringing, and had various priests and nuns teaching him. It was decided within the family that more or less Alex was going to grow up to be a priest. So he studied theology, and later on at university he studied theology. His undergraduate degree was in that. But he still had psychic experiences all throughout his life. He was having various predictions. He could tell people about themselves. He would know where people were, which is why later on he became very good working with the police on missing person cases. Mm-hmm. And he developed this through his degrees. He, at the end of the day, he got 5 degrees. He got his undergraduate in theology. He got a master's in theology, a master's in philosophy, a master's in education and counselling, and a doctor of divinity. So a very well-educated guy in psychology, theology, and philosophy. So he made a really good researcher, but also on top of that being a psychic as well. So he embraced his experiences, and as a sort of scientist, a social scientist, he wanted to understand these experiences as well. So put himself to full use with the American Society for Psychic Research, and he became one of their main participants, or guinea pigs, if you like, for around 20 years from the 1960s, the late 1980s.
Wow. Okay. And what kind of stuff was he able to do in the research, like when they were testing him?
Well, there were several things. One particular study that was published in a peer-reviewed journal, which was the Journal of the American Society for Psychical Research in 1980, was a study looking at a psychokinetic effect of his out-of-body experiences. And what that means is they were looking to see if they had evidence for survival of death through out-of-body experiences. Alex claimed that at any time he liked, he could actually leave his body at will and travel around. And in some cases, people could see this astral body. It's an apparition of the living again. So Alex would be in one place, he'd go to sleep, or he'd meditate and travel. And people in a different state, a different country, reported that afternoon having tea with him. Yet people reported him being in New York and in Canada at the same time. And so these reports were logged and people wrote them down and verified Alex being in two places at once, which just completely confused the psychical research community. And these instances are called bilocations. So he claimed he could do this, and there were accounts of it, so they took him into the lab. What they were doing in the lab was saying, well, if we put Alex in one room, can he see what image is appearing on an optical illusion device 4 rooms away? And this optical illusion device, you could only see the targets if you peered through this little spyglass, and it would have 3 things that he had to get right. There'd be a spinning disc working by a random number generator, and every time a trial was activated, it would stop, and it would select a quadrant, so upper left, upper right, lower right, a color for one of those quadrants, and a symbol. So it's spinning, and then you click the button of the research, and it stops, and it picks upper left, red eye, or bird, or something like that. And that's what he had to guess. He was working via an intercom system, so they could actually hear what his responses were. During this, he was having particularly high hit rates. In one of the trials, in many of the trials, he was producing 90% hit rates, which, you know, that's incredible accuracy. And in periods within this particular study that was published, periods where he was producing exceptionally high hit rates, so several correct answers in a row, they had a strain gauge in the same room, which was reporting a significant amount of activity during those periods of high hit rates. That was suggesting that something else was in the room besides that machine, and no one was in there. So they believed it was the starting blocks to actually being able to measure someone's consciousness being in a room several rooms away outside of the body, showing that consciousness doesn't hold a fixed locality to the living body, and potentially it's capable of acting beyond bodily death. So that was one of his abilities he was tested for, and then they used his psychic abilities when they went to haunted locations to see how well he could pick up information on the location. The other one that was unique, and it's just mentioned in various books, and I did mention it briefly in Conversations with Ghosts, and hopefully I will follow it up later and try and draw all this information together. He was claimed to have this ability called light projection, and myself and Steve Parsons have only found a few mediums in the past that seem to have, or not mediums per se, more so psychics. So we're not talking about people that specifically hold seances, just people that claim psychic powers in general, like a Uri Geller character. Alex claimed he had light projection, which meant that he could project light from his eyes onto walls and images. And he would be sat around a dining table having dinner with a family, and all of a sudden he'd mention this and say, oh, would you like to see? I can do this. And he'd project the image of a person onto a wall, and everyone's just dumbfounded as to how that's happened. He was later tested for this in the lab, but it was tested at the Maimonides Medical Center by Dr. Alan Vaughan and Chuck Honiton, who developed the Ganzfeld procedure into parapsychology, a process of altering your state of consciousness to produce psychic phenomena. And they tested him, and they saw these images he projected in a poorly lit room. They wanted to make the room slightly poorly lit to see if these images were luminous. And they saw the images he was projecting. They gave him particular pictures they wanted them to focus on and project. But they doubted their own experiences. They said, well, was it really objective? I mean, was he maybe sending this to us psychically, and we were seeing this as a hallucination? I wish this had been written up. It probably was. But when the Maimonides Medical Center stopped doing their parapsychology research, Chuck Honiton destroyed a lot of the paperwork because he didn't have the office space for it. And there were quite a few parapsychologists that contacted him in shock, asking for different studies that he said he hadn't got anymore. And they should have been, you know, there were some parapsychologists that would have happily taken them on, or they should have been donated to a relevant university library or something. But unfortunately, a lot of records from the studies at the Maimonides Medical Center, the raw data, it was destroyed. Thankfully, though, a lot of the stuff was published in various things, particularly a book by Professor Stanley Krippner, called Dream Telepathy. And that's a very famous book that still sells very well in various printed editions. And it's on all the studies they did about dream telepathy at the Maimonides Medical Center. But there we go. Those are the two main things that Alex could do, light projection and out-of-body experiences. He could project his body at will. He did some case of healing as well and dream interpretation, but those were kind of different matters that he wasn't necessarily tested for.
Now, you said he was capable of doing bilocation. So does that mean there was a physical version of him somewhere else while, like, almost like a doppelganger?
Absolutely. It was completely identical to him. And there is one mentioned in the introduction of Conversations with Ghosts, and also in Beyond Coincidence, his first book, he mentions that a few times. When you read into it, people don't realize they're having an experience that's more or less like a ghost. Until after the experience, just like your second type of telephone call from the dead, you have the experience, then afterwards you realize it couldn't possibly have taken place. So that's what the bilocation is. It's a person being reported being two places at once, and whichever is their spiritual body, this astral body, it looks exactly like them, it sounds exactly like them, and it's, in some cases, it's capable of affecting the physical environment. It can pick up objects, walk around them, and so forth.
Do you have any stories about him doing this?
There's one particular one in the book, which is similar to how I mentioned it earlier. He was staying in New York at the time. He was doing some studies with the ASPR. And I think he was staying with friends as well. People were meeting to do these studies. Anyway, in the middle of the night, his friend in Canada reported hearing a knock at the door. It woke him and his wife. He went downstairs to answer it, and his wife decided to stay in bed, but his wife was fully awake. She heard him answer the door and speak to someone at the door, and that someone was Alex. And he said, oh, you know, I'm sorry to wake you, I was just in the area, I thought I'd call by and say hello. So he invited him in, they sat down, they drank tea, had a conversation, and then Alex went. But the guy decided to wait and hear Alex drive off because it was snowing, and he didn't hear a car driving away. So he thought, well, perhaps Alex is having car trouble. He opened the door to look out, and there was no sign of Alex. There was no sign of a car, nor was there any sign of footprints in the snow leading away from the house. Later on, he wrote down his experiences and sent them to Alex. Alex, upon waking in New York, had dreamt this experience in a way. So it was during his dream that he'd had this astral projection. And he was obviously verified to be in New York. Both accounts were given to Dr. Carlos Osis, who later followed them up via interview with both of them, just to confirm that this experience did take place. And Alex was definitely in New York and not in Canada.
Huh. Too bad he didn't take a picture.
Yeah, there are some very sort of, again, it's like those cases that delve into myth and legend, some cases of people that went to an old pub or manor or something like that, and they stayed there for the night, and they found it very odd. Everyone was dressed in slightly old clothing and had a weird way of talking, and they left. They took photos. It was very pleasant. They go home. They tell a friend about it, and they say, oh, we should go there. They had really good food, and they go back, and there's no building there anymore.
Yeah.
But yet they've got photographic evidence, and they ask people about it, and they say, oh, yeah, that building was knocked down 50 years ago. And you're like, whoa. They're called time warp experiences in some cases, where people have actually encountered a time period and they've walked into a time period that doesn't fit their own. Yet in some cases they might have brought back objects, or in some rarer cases they've taken photographs. And, you know, tell this to the general science community and they'll just think, well, that's just not possible. Well, you're right, it's not possible. But we think of things in terms of 3D and fourth dimensional time and space. Time has a continuity, it's on a line, and we're just going forward. But that's our way, our construction, our human construction of measuring time. And we've created that ourselves. Time is all over the place. It's, as Doctor Who puts it, it's wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey. you know, it doesn't hold necessarily a fixed back and forth. So, you know, that's the thing that kind of opens up this idea that time travel may be possible in some respects. Maybe alternative dimensions are possible. This idea that every time we make a decision, it does create different paths of reality that we're living on at the same time, but we can't necessarily see. It opens up all kinds of possibilities into quantum consciousness, quantum reality, quantum physics, just areas that no one could really specialize in. You know, anyone that says that they're a quantum physicist and understands it is an absolute liar. It just goes into such depth. It's very philosophical, very, very philosophical.
And I honestly think that in order to incorporate all these unusual phenomena, from the UFO phenomena to the paranormal and stuff, we really need a new definition of reality. The one we have just doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. We're going to struggle. This is the good thing about the University of Northampton with the CSAP department, because we look at a lot of consciousness, and there's a lot of universities, believe it or not, that are shying away from looking at consciousness studies within psychology, because it's such an in-depth, tricky and philosophical thing for students to get their head around. Understanding existence, consciousness, our conscious awareness of existence, what this all means. I mean, right now I'm sat at a desk staring at a computer screen, and I imagine in my head that you're doing the same. But, you know, you're a completely different existence for me. You're in another country, but I have to grasp this concept. And can I really accept that I'm actually sat at a desk? What does this all mean? Where do I fit into this grand picture of things? What is reality? Are we being controlled by a bigger thing? When we're asleep, is that really a real reality? And this is just something that's made up. So many weird things. We struggle to get a grasp on what existence really means to us. And for humans, human society, human understanding, philosophy and psychology, it's all very new to us. And if we think we know everything there is to know about psychology and science, we're completely wrong. We're just scratching the surface at the moment, understanding how things operate and trying to tie things down into the laws of physics and A plus B equals C. Sometimes with human behavior, though, more or less all the time with human behavior, that's not always the case. Things just change all the time and we can't pin them down. And that's the same goes for hauntings and ghosts and things like that. You know, people have these experiences, but you know, just because you go back to the same place they had an experience doesn't mean, say, you're going to experience a ghost. So there's multiple explanations as to why they had that experience. And some of those explanations are just beyond our reach at the moment.
All right. That was beautifully said. Your website is just Cal Cooper, CalCooper.com.
Yep.
And what do you have up next?
Well, at the moment I'm getting this paper done, and then I've got to battle on with the PhD. If people go to my website or my Facebook page, Cal Cooper Parapsychologist, I will be looking out for participants to take part in my PhD by filling in a survey. And this can involve two groups of people. I'm just looking for anyone that suffered a bereavement but never had a paranormal experience to take part, who's willing to actually discuss these issues of bereavement and death. It's totally at your own discretion. Don't get involved if these issues are too sensitive for you. And the other group is exactly the same, but people that have had a paranormal experience during that bereavement stage. And so that's a new thing that's coming up. There's a new book project down the line as well, looking at the paranormal and sound. But that's very new at the moment. I'm working on that with Steve Parsons, and that's something later to come up. And apart from that, I've got some guest talks to do for the Society for Psychical Research and some other media appointments, so I'm all over the place.
All right. Well, the paranormal and sound definitely sounds like an interesting subject.
Mm-hmm.
So I look forward to that. Well, I thank you very much for spending some time with us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
All right, and here's some Psyche Corporation to take you out.
Shut the closet door, it's under the floor, the monster's there. The day I was born, you promised me hellfire. You were so sure I grew up waiting for demons to find me. I grew up hungry for ghosts to define me. Give me the nightmares, cause death doesn't scare me. I want the vampires and I want the glory. Side of my own suffering, bitterness, suffering, offering doom, 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 doom. Sick of waiting for your curses to catch up to me. Burn me, chill me, slake me, thrill me. I don't want the unicorn, I want the bloodsucker. Modify the uniform, cause I'm a monster. Of waiting for your curses to catch up to me. Bind me, chill me, slake me, thrill me. This is a sound I've heard before. It's like a voice asking for more. Ma chair éclate à cause des ailes. On grand spectacle de primavera. Give me the nightmares, cause death doesn't scare me. I want the vampires and
You're tuned to WBBR FM Ithaca.